And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
For two decades, Amy Walter's been a bright light in the world of political journalism and analysis. She's become something of an institution in Washington, but she's never been a subscriber to the sometimes smothering conventional wisdom that's so prevalent in that town. I sat down with her this week to talk about our current politics, her life and career, and her recent appointment as editor-in-chief and publisher of the venerable Cook Report, which has for years provided some of the smartest coverage of politics and campaigns in our country. Here's that conversation. Amy Walter, newly minted editor-in-chief and publisher of the Cook Report, which is a Washington institution. Congratulations, my friend, on your ascension to the throne.
Thank you, David.
This institution that Charlie Cook built.
He built it. He had the idea of it.
Explain the idea of it.
Yeah, that's a great question. So you have to go all the way back to 1984. I won't tell you how old I was. I was alive. So let's be really clear about
I know
that.
How old I'm you are. Like, I'm looking at a memo here with all your personal information.
You know everything.
Yes.
But, you go back to that era and look, obviously you still had campaigns and campaign donors, but you didn't have the sort of referees in the way that we think about them now, right? Somebody coming in and being a nonpartisan arbiter of campaigns and elections to say, look, these are the races that are real. These are the races that aren't. I know you're getting spun by all kinds of people about this person or this race or what's happening big picture wise. I'm just going to tell you what's really going on. And I'm going to build up the sources on both sides so that and sort of cut through all of this noise to give you the real unfiltered, unvarnished truth about the campaigns and elections. And it started on basically an old-fashioned computer, which wasn't old-fashioned then. but if you've seen the original Cook political reports, they came out on paper. And they were really the first of its kind of trying to assess and make sense of campaigns. And it was a labor of love for Charlie. He loved politics. He still loves politics. He's still going to be involved in the analysis business. But being able to do it from a perch that wasn't partisan was really a new idea back in 1984.
Yeah, there have been a lot of imitators since, but it really was a trailblazing thing. So is that computer now on display somewhere? Is it in the Smithsonian?
I think it's the Smithsonian. It should be. I think he's had it around still for a while. You know, like one of those, I don't know if it was actually the kind where you had to put the cards in it or something.
Or crank it up. You might have had,
with that handheld crank. Yeah, it was not exactly the most powerful instrument out there, but it's where it started.
And now here you are leading the thing. I'm going to tap your analytical savvy later in this discussion, but I know, you know, you're a very familiar face to people who follow politics because, you know, you're on TV all the time. You do broadcasting on radio, podcasts. So people know who you are, but I don't think they know much about you. We've been friends for a long time. There's stuff I didn't know about you. I did know you're from my neck of the woods here.
I am.
Talk to me about growing up in the suburbs of Chicago.
The suburbs of Chicago. My parents moved out to Chicago in the mid-60s. They're both from New Haven, Connecticut. And my father moved out with my mom, they were married at the time, out to California. He went to business school out there, but was looking for a place to come and work. He was in finance, didn't want to go to New York. So Chicago was a good place. Yeah,
greatest city
in the world. Go, right?
Yeah.
He was a money manager. Basically, he was at that time managing pension accounts, right? So for corporations and nonprofits and things like that. He was your classic, David, you appreciate this, the guy who would get up early, get on the Chicago Northwestern, take the train.
Where specifically did you live?
In Barrington, close to Arlington Heights. Yeah. You know, I know that train line very well, all the different stops between there and downtown. But it was, you know, your classic sort of suburban life that I led. And also because my parents were not native Midwesterners, we did not have the attachment to the place that many of my friends did, right? Who all their cousins and their families and the connection there. So it was a lovely place to grow up, but I did not feel like it was sort of an ancestral home.
Mm-hmm. And your mom, did she work outside the home or?
She did not. She was, you'll appreciate that she was the White Sox fan in the family. I think usually they're the Cubs fans, right? But you know, both my parents grew up in very working class families in New Haven. And I think her identity with that is what connected her with the White Sox, right? The White Sox are the Southside team, the working class team, and the Cubs are too bougie and, right? Those aren't my, that's not my.
She scoped that out even then, huh?
She knew that even then, right? Of like, okay, these are, and I think, and she also is, and I get this too, you know, she loves the underdog teams too, right? Everybody loves the Cubs. Nobody's given any love to the White Sox. And so to be there, I think I was in high school. When was it that they went to the AL Championship?
White Sox 1980, 83, 84.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So that was a big.
Well, the Cubs have, they're in a play for more love. They've traded all their stars away and made them.
I saw that.
So that is good. And was politics, was that something that was discussed in your home? Was that a big thing?
No, as I said, my mom's attachment to that sort of working class identity and to really, she's Catholic, a real Kennedy East Coast Democrat. That's really, if you want to give her politics. Meanwhile, my dad was a Reagan Republican, loved Reagan. Just
as did a lot of people out in Barrington.
As did a lot of people out there. That was very Republican out there. I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. But so my mom likes to take credit for what I do, saying, well, you know, you grew up in a mixed marriage. And so, of course, you understood very well what it was like to have to navigate between these sort of two warring factions. They didn't really war about it as much as my mom would just take glee in going to the polling place after my dad had, you know, left for work, and she would go later in the afternoon and cancel out his vote, right? That's what she would come in. And she loved being the one person in Barrington who would pick up the Democratic ballot in primaries, right? Because, you know, nobody was picking up that ballot back then. So they would sort of, you know, they had that sort of their own political differences, but it wasn't like we were a political family. Nobody was really engaged at a level beyond that. But I think when I really became interested in politics was going off to college and to meeting folks who were doing this business. And I was like, huh, I never really thought about this before. Campaigns, elections, seem interesting. Let's try this.
Colby College in Maine, huh?
David, you've been up there.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And an old colleague of mine from the University of Chicago, David Green, is the president of Colby College. Now, an outstanding guy. Before we leave high school.
Barrington.
First of all, did you have siblings?
I do. Yep. My I'm the oldest of three. So I have a younger brother who is now in Baltimore and sister who is in Colorado. So we're quite the, as I said, because we didn't really have the like roots in the Chicago area, we've now all sort of gone our separate ways.
Mm-hmm. And you're gay. Mm-hmm. And how did that evolve in terms of, you know, when did you come out? How'd
all of this go?
Yes.
Yeah.
And with your folks and.
My father died pretty young. He was 50. And I had just graduated from college. And my brother was in high school. My sister was in college.
Was that a sudden thing or?
It was an absolutely sudden thing.
Before you go on here,
yeah.
That must have been, I mean, I lost my dad, you know, when I was young and it was a sudden thing.
Yeah.
But that must have been incredibly unsettling and jarring and sad.
It was in a destabilizing way that, and you can appreciate this too, David, you know, at the time, I remember people kept saying to me, oh, he, you know, he's so young. And when you're just graduated from college, right? 50 seems like, whew, so old. What do you mean he was young? He was my dad. He's 50, right? But just that you can't really process all of that for what it means for somebody who really is at 50, you're in a prime of your life. When you're a kid, you don't appreciate what that means. And then also being at that time of your life, as I was, which blends into your question, you know, you're leaving school, you're trying to build your own life and identity. And, you know, I was living in Washington. I had felt like, okay, here we go, taking these steps to figure my way in the world. And then to lose a parent and feel like you're lost again, right? You're kind of swimming in this.
Did you just get a call? Is that?
It was like this. I still remember this so well. Again, this is all pre, so this is 1993. This is all pre cell phones and, mm-hmm. right? And running to pick up the phone. And you know, right, David, when you get those calls where you know instantly something has happened, right? They just say one word and you're like, I know something bad is going to come next. And so that feeling of like, right, the disbelief of this can't be possibly happening. I'm not supposed to deal with this.
Trust
now,
me,
right?
I remember so clearly my own experience. Yeah.
Do you still have that memory in your head? Like I still have that picture in my head. I remember I ran in the door, the phone was ringing. I ran through the door and I didn't even close it because what I expected to do was pick up the phone, say, can you wait a second? I need to close the door. Right. But then to be sitting on the floor with the door open and just collapsing is like still such a powerful memory.
What happened to your dad?
He had, it's called an aortic aneurysm.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know about those, but the problem with them is that they appear more like a flu symptoms. Because what's happening is your aorta, right? You have a leak mm-hmm. in your heart and it's the blood that is slowly pooling. And so you feel weak and you feel achy. So you don't, it's not like you have a sign of, oh, this is a heart attack, right? It feels like, ugh, I just feel terrible. And he did, to his credit, he went into the hospital to say, this doesn't feel right. And they didn't diagnose it.
Oh my.
And so he came home. And it is a very challenging thing to that aortic aneurysm because you have to catch it pretty early on. Yeah. And I think, in fact, Abdul might have had it caught early.
Is that what Richard Holbrook?
I don't know. That's a good question.
He was in my office the day that he died. He was in my office at the White House, and he looked terrible. And my then assistant, now State Senator Eric Lesser, you know, offered him some water, and because we were so worried about him, then he went off to the State Department and died during a meeting with Hillary Clinton.
It's really one of those things that they, again, I know that you think about a 50-year-old man is, right, a heart attack would seem not out of the question, but because this doesn't pose any of the same symptoms, nobody would right?
Yeah, it comes suddenly and
it's slow and then sudden.
Yeah.
Right. So that was, and then, you know, to have my brother still in high school. So the two of them had to sort of navigate that by themselves was also, you know, such a difficult thing, right? Of that, you know, I think for the three kids, we were at such different phases in our lives, and such prominent, or whatever, I don't know, prominent's not the right word, but just as at such critical stages of development and junctures, right? So I think how we each have sort of processed that and how it has impacted us is probably going to be different, but we were all in a younger phase of our lives.
And what about your mom?
You know, she is now, I think, in a really good place. She's retired. She moved to South Carolina, and it has been a long process. And I think she has found a really good community of people who, in this place where she's retired, who have been incredibly supportive, who didn't know him, right? So they've known just her. And I think that's also sort of a fascinating way to think about this, right? Of there's something about when you lose someone, you do want to be around people who knew that person, who can constantly remind you of that person. And at the same time, going somewhere where people just know you as this person that you are now, not what your life was before. So I think I haven't really talked to her about that, but I do find that, I wonder how that balance has been for her.
This discussion was part of my question about you.
Right, all the coming out. And so it was really, again, I think, boy, what would that process have looked like had my father not died at that point? Because I really had only started coming out to myself at the end of college. So I graduated in 91 and he died at the beginning of 93. So I didn't talk to anybody in my family about this, right? This was still I'm figuring this out for me. And at some point it was going to be, let's have a family discussion or, you know, bring the family into this. But now here it was where we're in this period of grief, and this was not the time for me to make my story a prominent one for the family, right? It was, I need to do whatever I need to do, but it's I'm not going to make that a thing right now.
You said your mom came from a working class Catholic family.
Right.
So how did she receive that?
Yeah, it was fine. I would say it wasn't like awful. It wasn't the, you know, and it's funny to think about too, like how different it feels just even having these conversations like this in the early 90s versus, right?
Yeah, today, 2021. Absolutely.
It's an entirely different place. And it is true that the church is very important to her. And I think that tension was there, right? Of what to do with that. And that people didn't talk about their gay kids back then, right? If you did have a gay kid, you just sort of moved on and talked about something else. Now, everybody, right? Oh, I'm going to the wedding. We have a baby. So it has been, let's just say it's been a process. But I think that for me, the process was also really important. And I think this is true for a lot of gay folks, again, especially those who were doing this at a time when there weren't like gay pride floats sponsored by big corporations, right? Where everybody now has Friendly Day, which is you were really forced to trust yourself, right? Like there's something that I'm just going to take as super important. This is me. This is important. And I'm getting all these outside pressures telling me to not do this or to not think this or to not be this,
not
but
be
I'm going to trust myself and not be myself. But I have got to do this. I've just got to trust this and to take this really deep dive into yourself and into what's important to you and what matters to you. And I think that gives me, it was a really good experience. Again, especially being in your 20s when you're so unsure of everything.
Yes.
Right? Who am I? What am I doing? Why am I here? And to have to go through this process really forces you to take stock of the things that matter, but also to say, okay, I just went really deep into myself. I know who I am, what matters to me, and I'm going to fight for that, right? I'm not going to give up on it. I think that was, again, you know, everybody's has their own struggles, but it's through those things that you find out really what matters and who you are. So in that sense, I think doing it at that age was fortuitous. And it was a time too in DC, you know, where there was a vibrant gay community, but it was still pretty quiet and segregated. And so, you know, you sort of built up friendships and relationships that were so different from the world you were working in or your professional life, right? Now they're much more integrated, but that was the different part.
When you consider social progress, the movement on gay rights and just, as you say, the integration of gay and straight and so on, breathtaking.
Unbelievably breathtaking.
How fast. And you know, now you've got, you're married to your long-term partner and you have a child and, and think about one thing this virus has done is it does make you think about the things that are most important and, you know, family, friends. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You arrived in Washington not as a journalist, not as an analyst, but as a participant. Right. You went to work for the Women's Campaign Fund. And this led you to a short-lived tenure as a campaign manager in one of the most momentous congressional races of the 90s. Talk about that.
And one of the other little known facts about that campaign. So this was 1992, 1993 at the Women's Campaign Fund. A woman runs for Congress in suburban Philadelphia, Marjorie Margolis Mosminski, wins in former news reporter for local news in Washington. She married a congressman from Iowa, who, by the way, was one of the Republicans who voted to impeach or to investigate Nixon, right? And he and she had kids of their own, but also had multiple children through his first marriage, and then she had adopted children. So she has this sort of fascinating story. And I was just really drawn to her. I went up when I was working at the Women's Campaign Fund and helped out on the campaign and met her press secretary there, this guy named Jake Tapper.
Yes.
Who had just graduated from college as well. And his father was the physician to the Mosminski family. So that was the connection there. So, it was this remarkable win on her part. It was the year of the woman in 1992. This Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, which now is overwhelmingly Democratic, but at the time was old line Republican machine area. She wins by a couple thousand votes.
Year of the woman in part because the Anita Hill,
exactly,
Clarence Thomas hearings happened in 1991, I guess.
Yep.
And this just ignited a reaction from women, and particularly suburban women, but women nationally. Anyway, go on with your narrative.
But you're exactly right. And there were a record number of women that won in the Senate as well. And so I went and worked for her on the Hill for a year, and then went up to manage the campaign. And she became famous, or infamous, however you would want to describe it, in 1993, then President Clinton trying to pass, feels all familiar, doesn't, budget reconciliation, right? We're kind of going full circle, which includes—
I pass a tax increase.
A tax increase. And
on wealthy people.
This is the main line of Pennsylvania. This is one of the wealthiest
of
counties
wealthy
in America.
There.
A lot of wealthy people. I mean, you know, there were a lot of things that you could do as a Democrat in Montgomery County, especially on social issues, but do not pass a tax increase in this county. She said she wasn't going to vote for it. She had voted for the first round. It came back after conference. She still said she was going to vote against it. Went on the news at 6 o'clock that night, Philadelphia, saying she was voting against it. She gets a phone call from President Clinton saying, I need you on this. She says, only if I'm the 218th vote, which you probably shouldn't do, because then the White House says, great, we got her, right? Yeah, like, we just, fine, we'll have you as 218.
Now, in fairness, most members of Congress would say, as long as I'm not the 218th
vote. Exactly, because I don't want to be the one.
The deciding vote, yeah.
She becomes the deciding vote. She and...
I remember the scene, and you
Pat
do
Williams,
too.
Right? Do you remember that scene?
Yes, where they're all waving bye-bye, Marjorie. And, you know, it was like she is walking dead.
It was like walking into a, it was like a Roman amphitheater, like with the screaming and the lions. And it was just, and she and I remember too, it was Pat Williams back when Montana had two members of Congress who walked together and cast those votes. And the campaign, of course, then became not just a referendum on tax cut, but that she said she was going to do one thing, right? I'm going to vote against it.
She went Washington, yeah.
Right. The president calls her and she says.
We should point out just parenthetically that her son married Chelsea Clinton. So now she's, not only did she help pass the tax cut, she's part of the family now.
She's literally part of the family.
I will say this, that was a courageous vote. I mean, you know, you measure courage in politics by whether people are actually willing to put their principles on the line and risk their careers for a principle. And that tax cut, that tax increase was part of what propelled the economy forward and the country forward. It helped lead to a balanced budget. And so, you know, I look back at her with great admiration, but, you know, she also did say she wasn't going to do it, and she did it, and she paid the price for it, and they sent this young kid in there to run the campaign. It's like, well, who's going to take this assignment? I guess we could send her.
Right, yeah. Oh, yay. Go up there and have people yell and scream at you for 8 months about why she's a traitor.
I was in the same position you were in, that I went over to work for Paul Simon, who ran for the Senate in Illinois in 1984. And I'd left the newspaper business to work for him. And next thing I know, I'm the campaign manager. And there were moments when I said, what the hell am I doing here?
What am I doing here? Exactly. Yeah. Right. And especially when, you know, it's a nationalized race, right? It's not
all eyes were on that race.
All eyes on this versus there are plenty of 25-year-old campaign managers out there, right? And they're running congressional races. But when it's, this is now taking on more than just, are you going to win this race? It's, what does this say about?
Right. So that must have been really stressful.
So it's stressful. I think, thank God, it was pre-Twitter. It was pre-internet. It was all, right? So the nationalization was not as intense as it is now, right? it really, you know, it was a big deal when a CNN reporter comes up and national news is still focused on it, but it wasn't in the way it could be now. So yeah, that was a year of my life that I won't get back, but it was good. And like they say, you know, it was a good experience. Glad I had it, but it was, yeah. It was not, totally enjoyable, mostly because you're swimming against, and you could, I mean, you've been in these races, Dave, but where you just feel like you're swimming up against a tide that, and it was beyond just.
And it wasn't just that district.
Vote.
I mean, look, exactly. That was the year that New Hampshire Republicans seized the House, and it wasn't a tide, it was a tsunami.
Yes.
And you were on the wrong side of that tsunami. What did you learn from that about yourself and about politics and about what you wanted to do with your life? And
yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I came away from that thinking, I don't think I want to run another one of these again. I know some people come away from doing that experience and there's the adrenaline and the, you know, even though you lost, this was a whole lot of fun. It was, you know what I really came away from it? I really enjoyed the people that I got to work with and, you know, obviously the people on the ground I worked with whom, David, you know this, right? You now have a friendship for life, right? Once you're
right.
In
yes.
That kind of battle, you're going to know each other and be with each other forever. But I also appreciated the consultants we worked with and just getting to see that side of it. I was really intrigued by and I really enjoyed it. But it was also like, all right, it's November. I don't have a job. Oh gosh.
Yeah.
Now what? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that it'd be helpful if more journalists actually had that experience.
Okay. So yeah. Can I riff on that for a minute?
Please.
Because I agree with that. Now I get the whole, you don't want to have, if you're going to come in and present yourself as nonpartisan to come in where you've had years of, you know, time spent with just one party makes it difficult to say that you're truly nonpartisan. But I will say this, I, you know, again, 25 years old, spent 2 years working there. And what it helped me understand wasn't the ideological piece of this or the partisan piece of this. I have now an empathy for what it takes to be a candidate and to be on a campaign. And I think that's what's missing from so much of the political journalism, right? Of, you know, the cynicism is so deep. And this is also why I love House candidates. And I covered the House and I love the House because most of these people, they are just like your normal people, right? You're the local dentist or the city council person that all of us know. And they wake up one day and they're like, you know what? I can make a difference, right? I'm going to go to Congress. And they have flawed, you know, things about their life that are flawed, and they have goofy family members, and you have the, you know, crazy kitchen cabinet that, you know, calls you at 3 a.m. giving you ideas for a campaign ad.
Been there. Yeah.
It is not what it's made out to be in the movies or in our popular culture, that these are all craven people who are here just to promote their own, you know, diabolical agenda.
Yes. Well, you know, you've lived in that echo chamber of Washington for a long time. And I think part of the skill demand of being really good at what you do is the ability to look beyond that, to listen to what's going on in the country. And yeah, there are all kinds of admirable people who are just trying to contribute and do something around this country. And we shouldn't be so cynical about that. We should be grateful that people are willing to step up and
exactly and
serve. You talked about covering Congress. You did a stint with the trial lawyers and you stayed in the political realm. And then in 98, Charlie Cook came along and offered you this gig in Congress. And you arrived at Congress to cover Congress at a pretty momentous time. there. That was the impeachment year. There was turmoil in the Republican ranks. Tell me about parachuting into that whole scene.
You know what, David? I look back at that time now, the period between 98 and let's call it 2008.
Yes.
And it was really stable, right? I mean, what you had was a very narrow Republican majority in the House that they were able to hold on to through, you know, from 95 through 2006. And you just didn't see these big changes. Maybe that's not the right word, but it was much more stable.
Although I would argue that the election of 2000, all of the disquiet over that and the fact that the election went to the Supreme Court, the pall that cast over relationships in Washington and around the country, you know, it hardened some of the partisan divide that dissipated a little after 9/11. And then the war, the decision to invade Iraq kind of intruded again. So, yeah, I mean, compared to now, compared to now, a lot of things look more stable. You had a succession of jobs. You succeeded Chuck Todd at the Hotline, which was one of the Cook Report sort of successor or imitators or whatever you want to call it. You did a lot of broadcast jobs, including you were the political director at ABC. Talk to me about that and about the experience of broadcast journalism versus more traditional print style journalism, which Cook Hotline, they have their own flavor of it, but it was more traditional journalism.
Yeah, and it was more... obviously, both Cook and Hotline are more insidery, right? I mean, that is for a very niche audience, right? So I had been writing for and speaking to a very niche political audience. And then I had to go at ABC, and now you got to talk to, you know, 300 million people about politics. And most normal people don't care about politics the way we do, David. And so how do you make the... how do you talk about it in a way that is not just appealing to people, but makes it approachable? And you had to think every day about, well, why should we, with a very narrow amount of time that broadcast news has, right? You've got half an hour, which really, once you get commercials and everything like that, we're really talking 20 or so minutes. Why should it make it into this? Why should what you're obsessing about, your, you know, sort of little insular political world, why does that matter? So that was a really important experience, to be able to talk beyond just a niche audience, to try to figure out ways in which what we do, what politics is at its core, right, is its impact on regular people. And I got there for two really interesting moments. One was the 2010 election, where, right?
Yes, I remember it. The backlash. You don't have to go into detail there. I still have the tire treads on my back.
and to come so quickly on the heels of, right, the 2000, this is what I meant about things being so stable. You know, we went from 1954 to 2006, the House changed twice, from 2006 to now, right? So obviously a much shorter time window. It's already flipped three times, with a good chance of it flipping again. So to go from, you know, 2008 and the, you know, Democrats' success, and then that gets flipped in 2010, and then to go to a race where, David, you know quite well, the 2012 campaign was so different from 2008, right? And I think, right, you go from historic and, you know, right, the long battle between Hillary and Obama and the primary and Sarah Palin and all of this. And then it ends up a pretty kind of boring re-election campaign. I know from your part it wasn't boring, but it certainly did not have the drama and interest of 2008, and obviously ever since then.
2008 was hard, but it was a magic carpet ride in a way. 2012 was a grind. You know, we were running for re-election, and we're still recovering from this epic economic crisis. People were unhappy. The organized opposition that ultimately evolved into Trumpism was more evident. You know, there were forces at play that were roiling our pot, and it was just a grind.
Yeah, but it also gave me the opportunity. I mean, this is where the networks still have so much opportunity to do stuff that, you know, I could never do at a smaller publication or even at a print publication, which is, you know, the debates, being able to have a platform there, to have a budget to be able to go do all the things like get on the Romney plane, and be on the right. So it really was, I think, you know, again, all of these different jobs have given me an opportunity to see politics, campaigns, elections from these different vantage points, which I think is so important. And as you pointed out, starting off working on campaigns, obviously a lot has changed in 1993. I mean, our biggest breakthrough technology we had, I remember this so well, on the campaign in 94 was you could blast facts.
Yes.
That was a big deal. You could send out one fax to hundreds of people.
Yeah.
Same time. That was it. So obviously a lot has changed, but the basics remain.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now back to the show. You left the network. You've been a hybrid ever since. You've been doing broadcast along with the Cook Report. You became the national editor of the Cook Report in 2013.
Yeah, the prodigal daughter is what I call it. Is yes, I've seen the other side, and here's what I really like to do. But it really was that, which is seeing politics from all these different vantage points and recognizing that, look, what I really love to be able to do is to stand sort of outside of it and really look critically at both what is happening, sort of the national trends and the bigger story, political story, as well as the individual campaigns and races and what we're getting from that. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to find places that do that, that aren't sensationalizing, that aren't all about chasing the shiniest object or trying to make the pithiest point on Twitter. And which is also why I love working with PBS and the NewsHour, and because we have time to do that. I get 8 whole minutes every Monday, 8 minutes. That's unheard of.
You also said something interesting. You said you learned a lot about the art of interviewing from watching Judy Woodruff. Mm. Who I think is sensational.
Just so good.
Tell me what you've taken away from watching Judy.
It's such a great point, because, again, I know we throw this word empathy around, and I think sometimes we misidentify empathy as being soft, right? It's like a soft art of being, oh, they're there.
Yes.
Really what empathy is, it's an ability to be curious. It's really curiosity, and to be curious about somebody's point of view. So instead of going into an interview with 3 million people have been killed under your watch, why are you so terrible?
Yeah.
Right? It's, can you tell me how you're thinking about this? Tell me why you're doing X, Y, and Z. Bringing people in a way that is, it's not that you're not critical. It's not that you're not pressing people. But it's the way in which you ask the question, which says, I am curious. I am truly, honestly curious to hear your perspective.
The question is, are you authentically interested in the answer?
Yes.
Are you trying to find out what motivates people? Or are you just trying to put points on the board or bring to it your preconception as to what the news is, what the answer is. Yeah, no, I think she is really one of the very best at that. It's one of the reasons why I thought her debate was maybe one of the best debates in 2020. I thought she had one of the most thoughtful debates. So I want to just take the balance of the time to talk a little bit about where we are and tax that big analytical brain of yours. Last night, there was an election in Ohio, a congressional race in the Cleveland area. Nina Turner, who had been the chair, I think, of Bernie Sanders' national campaign, a very outspoken progressive, versus Chantel Brown, who was a local Democratic official and county office holder. And this became sort of a surrogate battle of gargantuan proportions, with AOC and Bernie going in for Turner, Jim Clyburn, the venerable number three Democrat in the House, and the guy many attribute Biden's primary success to, and so on, going in with the Congressional Black Caucus for Brown. Brown won a race that Turner was leading by a wide margin at one point. What happened, and what is the meaning of it?
First, going back to the most important thing, right? Candidates and campaigns matter. So I do think that the fact that what this election really, it wasn't simply about the fact that Nina Turner was an outspoken progressive. She had been outspoken in her attacks, I guess you would say, on Joe Biden and on Hillary Clinton, the two people who actually did very well in the primaries in this district. This is a Biden district. This was a Hillary district. So again, if you're going to be an outspoken opponent, that is fine, but this is not the
don't
district
pick popular
that is
targets.
Exactly. They are not resident of that.
Let me just interject.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I think Clyburn and those folks very wisely made this a referendum on either you're with Joe Biden or you're against Joe Biden.
Yep.
And
right. That's so smart. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think to say this is the Joe Biden party. The split screen, though, that was fascinating, David, was at the same time, this is a quote unquote win for the establishment, for the Biden wing of the party, coming on the heels of Eric Adams in New York, who said, I'm a Biden Democrat, the not progressive candidate in the New York mayor's race. Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, not exactly a liberal firebrand, obviously part of the establishment, more centrist wing of the party. At the same time, this is happening, though, in Ohio last night. Progressives get a big win on the eviction moratorium by one of those members of the so-called squad, making a protest and getting the Biden administration to move her way. So you could argue that yes, the Biden wing is alive and well, and at the same time, the influence that Sanders, AOC, and those members have on policy and the direction of the party is still significant.
You know, one thing that it revealed, I think there's so many presumptions about American politics that are just wrong, but they have great, they have a great hold. One is that the African American voter is, you know, a far left voter, and that is just not true. The core African American vote, particularly among older voters who tend to be the core African American vote, is they're progressive on civil rights issues, but generally they're moderate to conservative on many other issues. And Biden dominated that vote. That's the story of 2020 in the primaries. That is misunderstood.
And 2016, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton's success with African American voters, also the real story.
The other big story yesterday was Governor Cuomo and the report that came out in New York. How does this story end?
I mean, this is obviously a guy who is not particularly interested in being out of office. he's not going to be shamed into resigning.
Probably the most pugnacious
yes.
person in American politics.
In American politics.
I mean, I think they're gonna have to bring the jaws of life in to get him out of that governor's
chair. I think he's daring the assembly to impeach him, was what it feels like to me. Yes. And unless they do, he's not going anywhere. And then that begs the next question, David, which is who runs against him in a primary? And the one name that has been out there for the longest is the state attorney general, who also is the person who brought this report to, right? She was the in charge of the report.
Which Cuomo has made that point repeatedly, insinuating. Now, we should point out he was the guy who asked her to.
Exactly. He asked her to do it. Right. So this is not like she took this on upon herself to give herself an opportunity to go and, you know, win this primary. But it is a look, I don't think that this has broader implications, say, for midterms or for the Democratic Party. Democrats have been across the board, the entire delegation, the president, you know, all calling on Cuomo to resign. So this is not one of those. So it puts, you know, the party in a pickle to have to defend Cuomo at this time. I just think the bigger question is for New York politics, which is its own share of brutal. Who's next after Cuomo in terms of who's next in terms of the hierarchy? Who would become a governor? And if you are the lieutenant governor, Kathy Hochul, you know, she becomes the governor if indeed he is impeached. And that would be point out that interesting to watch.
Automatically, that she doesn't.
That's right.
I mean, as soon as he is impeached, he has to vacate.
That's right. The office. But then she would be.
She's the acting governor.
Acting governor through, which is another thing I haven't really thought about.
It's a mess. Let's say that. And interesting, that's another bit of social progress, because you know, would have been much easier to ride this out some time ago. Listen, let's just finish up with this. One of the things I appreciate about you is that you are sophisticated in your analysis, but you're not cynical in your analysis. And when I read your stuff, I see someone who actually has reverence for this process, and as I do. Tell me about your level of concern about where we are now in terms of our democratic institutions, because things have happened in the last few, you know, I admit to being naive. I never thought we'd see a president. I mean, I lived through Richard Nixon. This, you know, Trump did things that would make Richard Nixon blush. And now he, you know, there are tools that Nixon never had to manipulate our politics. How do we get out of this? How do we revive and renew our system?
David, like you, I think about this a lot. And also it's why I like you so much, because you can be critical without being cynical. You can be analytical without being, well, I can't use the word I would use, but without being a jerk to other people, right? Like you're very approachable, because, and I think that's why you get all kinds of people to come and sit down and talk with you, because again, you're not in this to score points. And unfortunately, this is sort of what our politics have devolved into. I think about two things. One, the incentive structure is a big part of the problem, that you are rewarded for blowing things up, not for building things. The most prolific fundraisers are the ones who get themselves on every sort of social and other media. And look, I feel like, again, if we sort of go all the way back to where we started this conversation, back when we had, you know, in the olden days before Twitter, and you had three networks telling you what the news was, and you had party leaders in Congress who had a tremendous amount of power in determining who was going to make it and who wasn't. If you were a team player, you got rewarded with great committee assignments. Those committee assignments got you money. That money got you, you know, your incumbency protection. All of those have broken away, which leaves us feeling like we are sort of swimming in a sea of dysfunction. at the same time, I don't think that somebody like me, who being female, being gay, would be invited into a lot of those rooms. Only because we've sort of blown up that system do we have new people and new voices and new energy in this process. So that's a good thing. But with it comes all of the destabilizing. I'm also reading this book. I'm only starting it, but it is sort of fascinating where we talk about the lack of faith in our sort of traditional institutions. At the same time, we are now putting our faith still into people and to things that are just different. Like the thought 20 years ago of me getting into a car driven by a stranger, right? The level of faith that goes into that is kind of remarkable. Putting my credit card on the internet, I wouldn't have thought 30 years ago that that would be impossible. So the trust is there. It's that the institutions are going to look different. I do think that it is not about one person. It's about having the sort of public incentive is for people who are willing to do the work instead of just getting the glory. And until that changes, that's going to be difficult. Do I think we're on the cusp of something? I don't know. I feel like this is the thing about tipping points, right? In history, you never know.
Yes.
Where you are on that. Are we on this? Which side of the tipping point are we? And are we going to look back 20 years from now and say, "Ooh, well, that was rough, but it was pretty clear all along where this was headed." Because I don't know where it is headed right now. I think it is very dangerous to live in a time where we are living in two Americas who have two very different sets of beliefs and priorities, and where the inequities about the economy and where the growth is are so stark that of those, right?
As you point out, two very different sources of information or misinformation. But
yes.
Listen, I so appreciate you. And I neglected to thank you at the beginning for being a great fellow at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, a board member of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, and a great provider of light at a time when we need it. So, Amy Walter, it's always good to be with you, my friend. Thank you.
This was really fun. Thanks, David.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Koop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.